You're listening to Face Off, episode 95, recorded November 15th, 2010. This episode of Face Off is brought to you by AgileTask. AgileTask is a task tracking application featuring an agile workflow, tagging for organization and achievements. AgileTask, your lightweight personal backlog tool. Check it out by going to agiletask.me. And RocketShipIt. RocketShipIt, the complete web-based multi-carrier shipping solution for small businesses and developers. Shipping rates, integrated tracking, and labels for UPS, FedEx, and USPS shippers. RocketShipIt is shipping made easy. Go to rocketshipit.it. Welcome to Face Off, your face-to-face web technology podcast. I am one of your hosts, Jade Robbins.
And I'm Mark Sanborn.
And in this podcast, we talk about various aspects of web technology, such as web development, social media, and web entrepreneurship. You can get the show notes for this episode by going to faceoffshow.com. So the snow has come. It is official.
In
Montana, it's winter. We're not lying. It's totally winter now.
Did you get some snow this afternoon?
Yeah. Boston? Oh, it's good. Tonight it's supposed to be a big winter weather advisory, all that fun stuff. So,
yeah, I had to go to Bozeman today for my dad, and he's like, "You better go, you know, earlier in the day because it's supposed to snow later." Mm. But I think it's coming tonight.
Yeah.
So,
you come to Bozeman, you don't even call and say, "Hey, I'm, you know, hey, what's up? I'm in town."
Well, I knew you were working, and I just sneak in and then sneak out.
I'm gonna start sneaking into the Whitehall and sneak back out.
I'll have to tell you about it later. Anyways, so let's get into our news and follow ups. First news item.
This was really interesting. There's a couple reasons why this news item is interesting. It's that this weekend there was a GitHub outage, which is, you know, it's kind of a big deal, right?
Yeah, you know, I use GitHub quite a bit. I didn't really notice it because I wasn't programming on Sunday.
You don't work on the weekends. What are you talking about?
but yeah, I mean, I wanted to bring this up for a couple of reasons. One, it happens to anyone. I mean, GitHub's fairly big, I'd say. They got lots of users, and you'd think, you know, they're a code repository. You'd think they know how to code, and you'd know how to get this stuff right. But the fact of the matter is, even if you think you've got everything perfect, something can go wrong.
Right.
So it's very important to have a disaster recovery plan, which it looks like they did. I mean, they were able to get this up within a half a day or an hour or two, which is reasonable for a service like this. And we talked about disaster recovery a few episodes back. It's very important to do, and this is kind of a reminder for us all to be like on our toes and make sure we have our backups going.
Right. I mean, it's important to do because really these guys are just doing business as normal, and they goofed something up. Apparently they goofed something up in their continuous integration, which then ran their tests against their production database, which a lot of testing frameworks, when you begin tests, what they do is they erase the test database so that they, you know, there's fresh data. It's all new data what they put into it. So there isn't stale data or anything that can affect your tests. When you do that against your production database, you got a lot of problems.
Yeah. you know, in our episode about the Tech Raider, we talked about the rise of continuous integration. So it's interesting to see that these guys are using continuous integration. And it ended up messing them up a little bit only because they pointed it to the wrong server.
And they handled it well, too. I was notified via Twitter. You know, they were really clear saying it, and then they came out with a blog saying this is why this outage happened. I mean, especially with something that's a code repository with a lot of web apps, really, if your web app has a problem, it's kind of nice to hear what happened because, really, it does happen to all of us, and it kind of makes you feel a little better, too, you know, knowing that, you know, the guys that run these cool services are human as well.
Yeah, and I like how it didn't say GitHub made a mistake. It actually has the guy, he's writing in first person. A few hours ago, I was upgrading, and it's got the guy's name.
Yeah.
He takes full responsibility, and, you know, people took it well. They said, thanks for being forward with us as always. Stuff happens. Thanks for the report. Good work. I think this is just something you got to do. You know, if something goes down, you just say, hey, we had a problem, and sorry about it. And We
you know what's funny? This reminds me of Steve Bristol, who we had on the show from Less Everything. He was talking about once where he goofed something up. He was working late at night or something, and he took Less Accounting down for a little while. Came out, immediately said, you know, I screwed up. This was me out, you know. And the interesting part was really the outpouring of support. He had less angry customers and more people saying, man, you know, that happened to me once. It's, you know, it's okay. I'm sorry. You know, more people were saying, I'm sorry, that sucks that that happened, rather than people saying, rabble, rabble, I want my money back.
Yeah, sometimes people just want a straight answer.
Totally.
The other thing is they made a plan on how to prevent this in the future, which I thought was really important. It was kind of like, you know, we're trying to continuously improve and have less outages. They had three steps that they were going to take. You know, maybe one of the things were make it so the public or the production site isn't reachable from a testing virtual machine and things like that. So yeah. It's good that they're taking actions and they're improving themselves, and that's good.
Yeah. So if you have a news or follow-up, send us a shout-out via Twitter or email studiofaceoffshow.com. Let's get into our geek tool of the week. This geek tool came from Mark. I think it's a really cool idea. I see all kinds of uses for it around the house. And it is a three-pack, actually. So you have three-pack of remote-controlled outlets. So the remote has three buttons on it. You plug these things into your wall, and then you plug things into them. And then what, Mark? You take your remote control, and you push the button. It turns it on or off?
Yeah, exactly. Most of them, I believe, are RF, so you don't need to be pointing at it in direct line, which is important if the lamp is behind you or whatever and you just want to turn it off. These are great. They're like a little outlet, kind of like the size of a timer if you've ever used a lamp timer or anything. You just plug it into your outlet and then plug your appliance into that, and then you can control it with the button.
So this the remote here, the batteries are not included, but the remote uses a 9-volt battery, so it's not like those goofy watch ones that can be really hard to find where there's 1,000 different sizes and you don't know if you have the right one. So that's nice.
Yeah, very good point there. There are a lot of them. I believe the one that I had owned in the previously had the watch type battery, and it is kind of important. It's like one of those things that you go to the store and you're like, which one is it? Oh, they don't have it. Or if they do have it, it's like $5 for a battery. And it's like, So.
Yeah, because sometimes I mean, this is great for things like lights in your front room. Let's say you have lights on, you know, you can push a button to turn them on or off instead of having to get up and flick them off yourself. I was trying to think. I had some other good uses, but now it's failing me. Anything that uses a standard 12-volt plug that you don't, you know, maybe hard to reach, or maybe like in the wintertime you have a, you know, like a fan on in your house and you just want to turn it on from the couch because it's hot and sweaty out, you know, or a space heater or something like that. So I think it's just cool, cute little thing. And check it out.
Yeah, and $18 for a 3-pack is a pretty good deal, I would say, for something like this. So
yeah, according to Amazon, we are saving $31.
They do have some ones that you can kind of stick on the wall. It's more of a traditional light switch thing, but I think it's better to have the remote. I guess it depends on what you're trying to do, but anyways, take a look at those. And
yeah, get the link to them in the show notes. They're really cool. So if you have a geek tool, again, let us know. We'd love to hear from you guys. Let's move on to our web app. So the first web app, I'm actually super pumped about this because this is a problem I've been wrestling with a lot, and it's we've been talking about going to a conference this year. We went to CES last year. We signed up for CES this year. I have a feeling I'm not going to be able to go. And even then, you know, it was a cool conference, but I want other web app conferences, but I find that they're really hard to find. Like you can't just search for conferences, and oftentimes you get just the huge ones, you know. So what Lanyrd is, and if you go, it's lanyrd.com, is it's, you know, a way to find conferences through Twitter. So you log in through Twitter, and, you know, by default, if people have added a conference, you can see it in the list. So you can see in December and January, there's a lot of Fog Creek World Tour, old Joel Spolsky's going crazy over there. But then, I mean, I was, like, really excited to see it in Las Vegas in February. There's the Future of Web Apps Vegas. You know, I just think it's so hard to I found it really hard to find, you know, conferences. It's like, what do you search for?
Huh. So, like, you sign in with your Twitter account, and it automatically knows who you follow. So I see that Leo Laporte is speaking at Le Web in Paris. Not going to make that one, but
this is cool. You can click on a particular conference, and you can, like, you, if you want, you can just track it, you know, or you can say I'm gonna attend this conference. It tells you sort of the different topics for it. It tells you, like, related books. Like, Gary V is talking at the Future Web Apps Vegas. So, like, related books has Crush It. And a couple other people I don't really recognize off the top of my head. But it shows you a lot of the speakers, you know, the speakers who are on Twitter. So even if you want, you can check them out ahead of time. Like, well, that's weird. One guy doesn't have Twitter. But, you know, like, we want to check out these speakers, let's say, before we go. If we do decide to go to, like, the Future Web Apps Las Vegas. Like, oh, who's Joe Stump? I'm gonna check out his profile. Look at, you know, his Twitter. Apparently, he's appeared with, like, Jason Calacanis 3 times, John Rezig 3 times. So, I mean, he must know his stuff.
Cool.
So this is, you know, really cool. I find it very. I'm gonna ask our listeners if you know any other good resources to find good web conferences. Let us know, because we're Jones, and I think we really wanna go to at least one cool web conference this year. So let us know. We're really curious.
Yeah.
Yeah, pretty cool. And lanyard, of course, is sort of a reference to the fact that whenever you go to these things, you walk around with a lanyarded name tag everywhere that gets in your way constantly. Let's get into our next web app, which is a really simple, quick one. It's called worddomination.com. I get myself into this problem all the time. I'm working on an awesome crossword, feeling really good about myself, you know, cranking on it. And all of a sudden, 5-letter word starts with F, has an S in the third spot, ends with a D. And the clue is something that is just ridiculous. You can't figure it out. So frustrating. What can you do, Mark? What do? Just spend all day flipping through a dictionary? No, that's crazy. That's crazy talk, because you've got a web app like worddomination.com. What you can do with Word Domination is you tell it how many letters are in the word that you're looking for. So 5, right? And then you just fill in the letters that you know, like R, and then it ends with a D. Hit the little search button, and it gives you a list of words that it could be. And then you can click on that particular word, get a definition, get images about it, get videos related to that word. Super cool. Helping the crossword crowd.
Yeah, I like the way they've implemented this. It's a standard, you know, looking search box, but they have the little individual spots for your letters.
Right.
So you can say the third one is an E, and the last one's a S or something.
Right.
I don't know.
Right.
And search and... Yeah,
and they got Google Ads or something on there trying to pay for it. I think it's really cool. It's simple.
It's integrated with, like, what was it, dictionary? One of the, I mean, it tells you what the words are and what they mean and synonyms.
Images, videos, similar words, keywords, blogs, the word in blogs and forums and on Twitter. Too much to keep track.
So if you're really stuck and you want to, you know, a little boost, come here.
Right, because honestly, we need to talk about this, because you don't want to cheat. Listen, cheating, I never am for cheating. And this, I'm telling you this as someone who has played video games with Mark Sanborn, who is a notorious cheater on the internet. He is the worst. So, Mark, I am letting you know, you can use this as a last resort.
Last resort. You don't want to be entering any word cross competitions or anything and using this. But.
Right. But oftentimes you just want to do a crossword for fun, and then you get frustrated because you can't find that one word and you quit. And then, you know, it's better just to use this to find that one word to continue having fun. If you end up using this for every word, maybe you should find a different hobby. You know, that's how it happens. Hey, if you have a web app, or as we said, a Geek Tool News and Follow-Up, let us know. Go to twitter.com/faceoffshow, give us a tweet out, or email studio@faceoffshow.com. Love to hear from you guys. Let us know. And we always can use your help to help get the show on the road. All right. Let's get let's move on to our topic this week, which apparently we're meteorologists now, Mark, because we're talking about the cloud.
Yeah. I was about to say that we're talking about the developer side of the cloud instead of the consumer side of the cloud, but you went for the meteorologist style, so... But yes, we're talking about the developer side of the cloud,
Okay. I mean, really, even developers are consumers of the cloud, right? Developing a cloud would be like building your own storage cloud, which is pretty different. Or I'm meaning
instead of using, like, Gmail is in the cloud, like email in the cloud.
Right.
You know, we're not talking about that. We're talking about making Gmail, I guess.
Right. Using apps that use cloud services. Which is a tough term. I mean, cloud is a loaded term these days. It used to be pretty specific. I mean, I heard a lot of it when the university that I work for, we were looking at Google Apps for email. And that was sort of the first time we start hearing like, ooh, the cloud is different. This cloud is this sort of ambiguous place where you put your stuff and don't worry about it. And now it's kind of interesting because almost like any software as a service kind of says, like, you're in the cloud. And it's kind of, I mean, it's kind of morphed. It used to be the cloud was distributed among servers all over the world, you know, this sort of ambiguous cloud. And then now it's just kind of like, if you're not doing it yourself, it's in the cloud.
Yeah. It's a very good distinction. Another one you could say is infrastructure as a service.
Yeah.
Meaning, you know, for example, you could take your app and you can scale it through a REST API. We're familiar with that, as we've talked about REST before.
Yeah.
You know, simply adding servers or load balancers or databases just via a REST API. You know, when your app is sluggish, maybe it detects that there's a ton of users and it just says, oh, we need more servers, and it adds servers by itself. That's kind of what we're talking about here.
So we mentioned, you know, you kind of passively mentioned Gmail, you kind of mentioned servers. What can you find in the cloud these days?
Well, there's a couple of different things. There's storage. A lot of people are familiar with S3 by Amazon, which is kind of that, you know, that's kind of the Gmail type attitude where it's like, here's this giant storage, you know, and infinite amount. It's this much per megabyte or gigabyte. I don't have to worry about it. I can just throw all my data up there.
Yeah, it's being shoved in like one place. And who knows what Amazon's doing once behind the scenes where you shove it. All you know is you're shoving it to S3. It's the same place in S3, but whatever they're doing on the back end, you don't even know. You're putting it in Amazon storage cloud.
The first thing you kind of think about when you think about, you know, like you were saying, what is Amazon doing with it? Well, that gets people nervous. They say, well, is my data going to be there? What if they crash and stuff? Well, Amazon service level agreement has a commitment to 99.95% availability for the specific region. So it's always good to have an SLA, a service level agreement. it's remote. We talked about disaster recovery. S3 is a perfect solution for going remote and storing your data off-site.
That's what we use to back up AgileTask, man.
Yeah. The biggest advantage of using the cloud is, you know, in the instances, I guess, is the next section. You know, you've got storage. There's also servers. You can actually get a virtual, a VM snapshot of a Linux or a Windows server. Is being able to go from one server to 100 in a matter of minutes. If you've made the next Twitter and your people are coming in constantly like crazy and you need to scale, if you were doing it the traditional way, maybe you were co-locating or something, you would have to go out and buy a server, wait for it. If you're in a big city, maybe you can go down to a shop and start buying some servers. But typically you have to buy those online and have them delivered and put them in the rack and, hire sysadmins and all kinds of stuff. With Amazon, you could just say, give me 10 more servers. I need them now.
Instantly. Right.
I need a load balance. Okay, here's a load balancer. So
right, and that's sort of like your cloud is instances. So you don't know what server these virtual machine instances are being spun up on or anything like that. It's just give me more, and bloop, Amazon does the rest behind you, and all of a sudden you have 10 more servers.
Another service that is commonly offered is content delivery. This kind of goes hand in hand with the S3 and the storage. Right. Is saying stuff like, I want to have, you know, people in the UK fast access to my digital assets, like images and videos and things that take a while to download. You can say, store these things on these 8 different regions, but I want Asia, Europe, Pacific, right. East, and, you know, it's distributed, and then it's faster for the people that are in that region.
Right. So S3, I think S3 can count as a content delivery service, but really, I mean, that's a good thing to think of. S3 will do any sort of storage, whatever you want to throw at it. I mean, it really will take care of, but a content delivery service really is like looking at optimizing which content is taking care of, which region is getting content from where, so that's the fastest, you know, not one server is getting hammered. You know, it's really looking at getting content out to people in the fastest and most distributed way possible.
Yeah, a lot of these, especially the Amazon cloud ones, are very, they work tightly together. So like S3 by itself is on a specific region and you pay for that, just that region. But you can say, I want this same data distributed for the, and you check off the different regions you want and it'll automatically propagate to them and you pay extra for each region. But yeah, so it makes it really easy to do that. Another service that they offer is Simple Queue Service, which basically just allows you to put text in a queue and you can have workers pull from it, and when a worker is grabbing or reading a specific queue, no other workers can grab that same queue. This is a problem for this kind of solves a problem if you have something that takes longer than a user is expecting to wait for it.
Yep.
You throw it in a queue and then you get back to that user later on. With Agile Task, we were kind of thinking of maybe using a queue later down the road if we need one, where achievements, if it starts taking a while to figure out what achievements that person's about to get, we might send it to a queue service and then show it to the user whenever we get it.
Yeah, exactly.
Another use is like you need to you've got a user that uploads a bunch of Word documents and your service is to automatically convert all those to PDFs or something. That might take a few minutes or longer. So you might throw those in a queue and then have workers grab them and give them back without the user having to sit there and wait for them to come up. There's different things to do that with a Simple Queue Service. It's really simple. You just start it up and call to it and add things to it from different instances. It's in the cloud. You can do it manually, but that's another service to do in the cloud.
Yeah.
Another one along the same lines is Simple Notification Service, which allows you to push out to applications. Huh. Applications, you set up subscriptions or like topics, they call it, and then your application subscribe to that and it pushes out via HTTP. I tried to look to see if it has to be like a public facing IP. I assume it does. Mm-hmm. In order to get the push notification,
or probably could be an internal Amazon IP as well.
Could be.
I mean, a lot of these
internal
are really designed to work well with the different services, because I mean, as I understand it, Amazon developed these services as they needed them and then are like, well, maybe we should just sell this too since we developed it.
Yeah, that's a good point. So we talked a lot about Amazon and some of the different ones. There's also other services out there. I guess it's good to mention here that there's a lot of people using Amazon's cloud infrastructure. 37 Signals, Dropbox, which we've recommended on the show, I'm sure a million times, and love that service. They use S3 to store. Not sure if they use any of the instances or some of the other services, but they're using S3 for the backend storage. Mm-hmm. A competitor to Amazon is Rackspace Cloud. They offer similar services. Azure, which is Microsoft's service.
Which it was in our Tech Radar was kind of trending upward. It looks like people are starting to trust Microsoft or Windows. It's Windows Azure, the future made familiar.
Yeah, I think Microsoft's going to have an advantage for the Windows instances just because they're Microsoft and they own Windows.
Well, yeah, I mean, the hard part is depending upon what operating system you're using, virtualization can be very low weight or very heavyweight depending upon your host OS integration. So, for example, we at work, we can use KVM to spin up a virtual instance of Linux, which KVM, you know, has lots of really good integration with the Linux kernel. So really, it doesn't, you know, just to sit and chug your normal sort of Linux application doesn't really use much RAM at all. If we really wanted to go crazy, you could do like a container like OpenVZ, and it uses just it literally, I think, uses the same Linux kernel as the host. It just passes off hooks and stuff, which is crazy, but... but like in KVM on Windows, we get massive. I mean, we get to the point where we have to actually charge extra if users want to use Windows on their VM because it just uses so much more active RAM because it, you know, it's just not as good at virtualizing the Windows kernel. Whereas I believe Microsoft's virtualization products are probably a lot better at that. You know, you can probably spin up a lot more VMs on one host because it has better, you know, host OS integration.
Yeah, I think Amazon even charges a little bit extra for Windows. I think it's for the micro instance, it's like a penny more, right. Which can add up. It'll be interesting to watch. That one's on the Tech Radar to watch to see what that happens, especially if you're running the .NET languages and you're into the Windows stuff.
All right, so
I make it sound like so I'm the only like way totally for... not into it.
Yeah, the only way. So Mark, you're telling me the only way for me to get in the cloud is to pay for it. That is. Poppycock. I am very upset.
So there's a lot of, especially I think the larger companies are really, they don't want to be giving away their secret sauce to Amazon, even if they just don't want to trust maybe a third party, or maybe they don't want to pay for it. So what they have is open source solutions.
Can I interject something? One thing that companies have a lot of trouble with when it comes to the cloud, because the whole point of the cloud is it's ambiguous. You don't know where the servers are. You don't know anything. It's just you push to the cloud. A lot of people and businesses are bound by interstate trade regulation, or you know, so where it's called ITAR. I can't remember what ITAR stands for, but basically it means like if you have data that is sensitive and can be considered sensitive to the, you know, security of the United States, it cannot leave the country. And the cloud, sometimes if you're paying for the cloud, that poses a problem because you're like, oh man, I'm uploading this storage to the cloud. Amazon does it right. You know, I can pick an instance in North America. Still, North America could mean Mexico. It could mean Canada. And oftentimes there are restrictions with that. So a lot of times building your own cloud is a possible solution that you have to consider.
Yeah, that's a good point. I believe to be PCI compliant with all, you know, if you're hosting credit card numbers and things like that, it can, there's some restrictions too. So with that, we have open source solutions. There's two big ones, OpenStack, which I believe is a Rackspace sponsored project.
Not sure.
They're trying to make a clone, I would say, of Amazon's
right.
cloud.
It's kind of like EC. You have the OpenStack Compute and OpenStack Object Storage, which is kind of them saying like, oh, here's compute. That's kind of like EC2. Object Storage, I looked into it. I couldn't figure out if it's S3 because it seems more like a key value store rather than a sort of file data store, but I could be wrong.
I listened to the podcast on the Floss Weekly show about OpenStack, and they were definitely in kind of the earlier stages, but mm-hmm. it's very promising. They've got NASA, Citrix, Dell, who else? Intel, lots of big names.
All kinds of people.
I think the main reason, too, is this big push is that Amazon's starting to control a huge amount of infrastructure via the cloud, and I think there's just a lot of people want more choices. They want they want to be able to make their own private clouds.
Totally.
If they need to control the data and things like this. Another one is Eucalyptus, which is just another open source one. I don't know as much about this one.
It's more computation, if I recall correctly. It's more about being able to spin up VMs easily and managing your virtual machine. So
more virtual machine related.
Right. I don't remember if they have much on storage, but Basically, the newest version of Ubuntu Server Edition has like eucalyptus. When you boot with the new Ubuntu server, often it'll ask you kind of like, well, they have like some sort of pre-made templates. Like, well, is this a DNS server or a LAMP server? Or another one now is a virtual machine host. And if you select that, it installs eucalyptus for you by default.
Awesome.
Yeah.
So, Mark,
I got like one computer. I can't build my own cloud, but I don't know. I can't pay for these cloud services with, you know, I don't have money floating around all the time. What am I supposed to do? This is stupid.
Well, if our show piqued your interest and you're like, I want to play around with the cloud and I want to get in there, the Amazon's offering a free tier.
Oh, man, cool.
Basically, all of their services that we just talked about are free for a year in limited amounts. For instance, you have 750 hours of elastic load balancing, let me say 750 hours of EC2 running a Linux micro instance. If you do the math on 750 hours, it's basically 24 hours for a year. And what a micro instance is it's 612 megs of RAM. They don't really specify the CPU, but basically it's like a small, you know, one of the smaller VPS type solutions. It's comparable to that.
Yeah.
They have the load balancing, which means you could run two instances and load balance between the two of them for free. You would have to pay that for that second instance to try that out. But Elastic block storage and S3 is 5 gigabytes and the Elastic block storage is 10 for free. Plus, they have some restrictions for monthly transfer fees, 15 gigs of bandwidth in and out for the month. But that is enough to get you at least to play around, you know, start instances, stop them, maybe start up two of them and load balance them and play with them. You know, that might cost you like a penny. But if you want to just get going for free, they're offering a lot. I think it's really cool. I did it, started a service or a server, and I actually ended up moving some stuff over to it because I liked it.
Totally. Yeah, I like it too. I'm really glad they offered the free tier because honestly, I never would have, even though it's super cheap, I never would have played with S3. But really using duplicity with S3 is so easy, and it's so nice to just know my backups are somewhere I can think about it. You know, before I was like looking at using duplicity to like SSH into my local Linux server, which was okay. But then it's like, it's my own personal traffic. It's like, nah, this way it's just between my VPS and Amazon. Totally happy with it. And once my free year runs out, I will gladly pay the cost because it will be super cheap and it is a load off my shoulders. I totally dig it. So use this free tier to play around with, you know, even run with their EC2 and Elastic Load Balance and definitely at least S3. I think if you haven't checked out S3, you got to because it's really cool.
They do require a credit card to sign up just because there are no limits. Once you sign up and you're running S3, there's no limit to how much bandwidth you can put in there. This is like production ready stuff. So they do offer that or ask for that, but they offer a accounts tab where you can kind of keep tabs on your data. And if you're just testing it out, you're probably not going to go over those anyways.
Yeah,
like I mean, what is it, like 10 gigabytes, and if you're backing up a MySQL database or something, it's like a couple K. You won't have a, but yeah, check it out,
totally worth it. And that can be sort of your way to dip your toe into the cloud. So that wraps it up for this episode of Face Off. I want to remind you, you can subscribe to the show by going to faceoffshow.com/subscribe. You can subscribe all kinds of different ways there. Let us know if you have any ideas or Geek Tools web apps for the show by going to faceoffshow.com/feedback. There you can get our Twitter URL, our email address, all that stuff to get a hold of us. Help us out. We really love hearing from you guys, so please do that. Thank you for listening, and we will see you guys next week.